Blog Talk Radio.
Ooh. Yeah, yeah. You already know what time it is. It's that official time. When we take this worldwide. Let's go.
So now it's time to turn it up. Surf the radio waves as we begin to burn it up. We all up in your area like landscape. Definitely bringing you the power slamming pancakes. It's the mandate that you tune in. It's time to move out so we can move in. And recognize that this is no illusion. I'm here to clear the air so that there is no confusion. It all started off in the book of Genesis, when Jacob was wrestling with who he thought was his nemesis. And when the man saw he couldn't overpower him, he touched his hip but he really couldn't devour him. And from that point, then we hear a name change. Rearrange the game, so now we gotta change lanes. So I'm here to let you know it's time to listen to the Pancake and Power Slam Show. Let's go!
Turn it up, turn it up. It's the Pancake and Power Slam. Turn it up, turn it up. It's the Pancake and Power Slam. Turn it up, turn it up. It's the Pancake and Power Slam. Turn it up, turn it up. It's the Pancake and Power Slam Show.
Episode 195. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Pancakes and Power Slam Show, hosted by Sports Illustrated and Crave Wrestling's Chris Featherstone. We're going to have a lot of fun today. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, when you totally overhaul and upgrade your equipment by miles, that's what happens when you can completely update your studio. You have it on the first day, and and this is what happens. But ladies and gentlemen, 195 episodes, and we are going to have a fantastic time. I am Chris Featherstone, and I would love to introduce, ladies and gentlemen, the one, the only fallen angel, Christopher Daniels. How are you tonight, sir?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks for having me, although I'm not quite sure I'm ready for this because I have a waffle but not a pancake, so I'm not sure if I should be on the show. I hope I'm not, like, sent aside for a different guest. I can go make a pancake real quick. I just wasn't prepared. I apologize to the fan base.
It's totally fine because you're a natural heel, so of course you're going to go against the grain
and get
waffles instead of pancakes.
You know me so well, Chris Featherstone. You know me so well.
Indeed. I tell you what, Chris, you are I've been watching wrestling for over 30 years, and I would have to say that Christopher Daniels is one of my favorite workers. I just enjoy your work, and I've been writing. I wrote for Bleacher Report for over 3 years. I currently write for Sports Illustrated, and I love just critiquing professional wrestling, and I've watched hundreds and hundreds of thousands of wrestlers in my career. And I just really always enjoyed your work. But there are some questions that I have of just wondering why Christopher Daniels has went through the journey that he's gone through. And I'm very intrigued to find out more. So I really, really appreciate you taking your time to be with us tonight and be with all the live listeners. We have a lot of live listeners that will enjoy the road and the journey that we have tonight, talking about the career of Christopher Daniels.
All right, let's crack this open then. It sounds like it's going to be an interesting show.
Absolutely, sir.
And not just because it's about me, but go ahead.
Of course. Well, I think it's always interesting. We've had 195 episodes, and each and every one of them have been absolutely stellar. Tonight's going to be exciting because you know what's so interesting about Christopher Daniels is that you've been in the business for 22 years. Is that correct?
Yep, coming up on 23 this January. So.
Wow, incredible. And in those 22 years, you are one of the only active wrestlers who have had experience in WWE, WCW, TNA, ROH, and New Japan. Am I correct on that too?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I'm not sure. I'm sure there are a couple more, but maybe I might be the one that's the only one that's still active.
Yeah, right. Active wrestlers, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's something as well. And you're I hope that you don't get upset by me. Well, Google already beat me to it, but you are a 45-year-old man that wrestles like a probably a 25-year-old man, and that's always captivating. So, and it seems like, you know what's so funny about you and your age and your experience is that it seems as if you have I watched you in a live show recently in ROH, and I got a good friend of mine one of our staff members here at Crave Wrestling, I told him I really got him hipped to the work of Christopher Daniels, and I said, man, you know, he's 45, and he wrestles like he's 20 years younger, and that he has 10 years left at least. So, how do you? I mean, is it a cardio thing? Is it just wrestling for so long to make it seems like you can do it in your sleep? How are you able to stay and keep up? Because we have other 45-year-old people in the business, and it really seems as if they are literally on their last leg. So what differentiates Christopher Daniels and having such Chris? It's like fine wine; you get better as you age. So how is that possible?
Well, first of all, thank you for that. I appreciate that that observation. It's a lot of little things, like you talk about cardio, you talk about like keeping yourself in shape, and all of us as wrestlers do that. But another thing, another facet of it is the mental game, and a lot of it is the fact that I still love what I do. I still enjoy going out and wrestling in front of fans, and it's sort of a personal, like I push myself because especially working in Ring of Honor with so many talented guys, I want to go in there and still prove that I'm as good as any of those guys are. And so, yeah. You know, I push myself to be able to keep up with guys that are, you know, 5 years younger, 10 years younger, sometimes even 15 years younger than me. You know, after 22 years of wrestling experience, I sort of know what I can and what I can't do, and I try to focus on my positives and my strengths, and that's how I can put out. That's how I can go out every night and wrestle and perform at that top level. You know, I never try to do more than I think I can do, and I know what works for me as a performer, as a wrestler. And I go out there and I try to give that to the fans every time I'm in the ring.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's absolutely incredible. So let's journey down the road of Christopher Daniels here. So let's go all the way back to the beginning. And I've interviewed dozens and dozens of people here on the show. And I always like to wonder why wrestling? You know, I can share my story. I'm actually working on a book about just my personal story. Of just becoming a wrestling fan and eventually a wrestling journalist. But for me, it was my great-grandma that made me start loving professional wrestling. What was it about Christopher Daniels? Well, before you were Christopher Daniels, what was it about you? Or was it what was it that said, you know what, professional wrestling is the way to go. This is where I'm going. There's no other option. Was it a match? Was it a friend who liked wrestling who invited you over? What was it that captivated you about professional wrestling to endeavor in the career?
Well, the truth of the matter is there were two sort of distinct segments of my life. Because when I was young, well, let me explain. First of all, there was a period in my time where I was just a fan of professional wrestling. But at that point in my life, I never thought that I would be able to become a professional wrestler. You know, when I grew up in the North Carolina, I grew up in North Carolina, which was the sort of the middle of the Mid-Atlantic territories, which ended up growing into the NWA and then into WCW. So I grew up watching guys like Ric Flair and Dusty Rhodes and the Road Warriors. And, you know, I got to see the Four Horsemen. And, you know, at that period in time, the average professional wrestler was like 240, 250, 260 pounds. You had guys like Nikita Koloff and Lex Luger and those guys. And I was never that big of a guy as I was growing up. I was, you know, sort of average size. So, like, when I grew up watching professional wrestling, to me, the idea of being a professional wrestler was one of those pipe dreams. Like, I didn't think, oh, well, I'm going to gain 100 pounds and become this muscular guy and be able to be a pro wrestler. So as I grew up watching it, it never was a, oh, I'm going to do that one day. It was, wow, I love this. This is entertaining. It kept me captivated, but I never thought this would be a thing that I could do. And then later on down the line, after I went through high school, I went through college, I graduated college with a degree in theater with the idea that I was going to be an actor. And so once I graduated, I moved to the Chicago area and was trying to get into the theater scene. But it was so very difficult to find work on a paying level. I mean, it was easy to get into like a theater crew or a theater club, I guess you could say. But, you know, at the same time, I was living on my own. I was paying bills. And so I had a job that took away from the time that I could be in the theater. And then so I found the paying gigs that I found were in children's theater. I had a few of those. But at that point in my life, I was dating the woman that I'm currently married to now. I was dating her, and I told her just off the cuff, like, hey, you know, if this acting thing never works out, I could always be a professional wrestler. Ha, ha, ha. And she got that in her mind, and she found a wrestling school close to where we live, and she made an appointment for me to meet the person that ran the school. His name was Sam DeCero, and the school was Windy City School of Professional Wrestling. And so she says, I went into that meeting with Sam, and I came out with my eyes glazed over like I was hypnotized. And honestly, at that period in my life, this was the end of 1992, I was a little discouraged with acting, and I thought, you know what, step away from it for a bit, and I'm going to give wrestling a try. And if I wash out, if I fail at professional wrestling, I can always tell my family, hey, you know, I gave it a shot. I tried it. And so in January of 1993, I took out a loan with my mother, who co-signed for me, to pay the tuition to go into the wrestling school, and started in January of 93. And by April of 93, I was wrestling matches. And it all started from there, actually. Like, I got a modicum of success within Windy City Wrestling, which was the promotion that the school was affiliated with. And I was there for 3 years and then decided to move to California. And that was where I started sort of branching out into the independent scene after I moved to California.
Mm-hmm. So basically what you're telling me is that your wife, your then girlfriend, future wife, pivotal in you becoming a professional wrestler. Is that what I'm hearing?
Absolutely.
Correctly?
Absolutely. If it wasn't for her, I wouldn't have, because it wasn't in my mindset. Like, I liked it, but I didn't think at that point that, and you have to understand too, this was 1992. So now at this point, people like Sean Waltman have been successful. People like Shawn Michaels have been successful. People like Bret Hart, who weren't the Ultimate Warrior, who weren't Kevin Nash. They were smaller guys, comparatively speaking. And so, like, in 1987, when I graduated high school, I wouldn't have thought at that moment, oh, maybe I can be a professional wrestler. But when the opportunity arose in 1992 and I saw guys that were smaller sort of making a name for themselves, I saw an opportunity. And one of the things that Sam DeCero was very sort of forward thinking in terms of his business model, he saw that there were a lot of smaller guys that were becoming interested in professional wrestling. And so Windy City at that time had basically they had weight classes within their professional wrestling promotion. They had a heavyweight champion, they had a middleweight champion, and they had a lightweight champion. And the lightweight champion was basically patterned after the cruiserweight, the light heavyweight divisions that would come after that. So like when I started, I became lightweight champion sort of early on in my career there at Windy City. And if Sam had been sort of, if he had fought with inside the box the way that a lot of wrestling promotions did, there wouldn't have been an opportunity for a guy who at that point, at that time weighed 180 pounds to become a professional wrestler. He could have easily said, oh, you're too small, kid. Or he could have said, oh, you're too small, but I'll take your money and you know, take advantage of you. But instead, he gave me the opportunity, and he had a lot of, like, smaller frame guys that were still very talented and still willing to learn and go in there and work hard. And so if it wasn't for Sam, I would have had that same opportunity as well. I would have looked at wrestling the way I did 5 years prior and been like, oh, I can't do this. I'm not big enough. I'm not good enough. And luckily, that wasn't the case.
Wow. That is incredible. And what's even more incredible is that I'm fascinated in the fact that your wife helped you. That is like every man's dream for their wife, the biggest support for them to be a wrestling fan even. I mean, wow.
Well, I can't say she was a wrestling fan. She was more of a fan of me than she was of wrestling. She completely supported me. And my parents did the same thing. You know, when I told them, a couple years after I graduated college that I was looking to be a professional wrestler, they could have easily said, absolutely not, we're not going to do this. Mm-hmm. But they helped me, get the money to go into wrestling school and have supported me every step of the way. They hate to see me hurt. They hate to see some of the stuff that I've gone through. And my wife's the same way. But at the same time, they understand that now I've sort of found my passion. And they've backed my play ever since.
Yeah, I mean, my angle is, you know, it's not about her being a fan. It's the fact that a lot of people, you know, when a lot of men tell their significant others that they want to be a wrestler, so many girlfriends, so many wives are like, no way, you know, and that's just fascinating to me that she not only said yes, she actually aided in the process. So that's absolutely incredible. So you are known as being one of the best indie wrestlers of all time. And your indie work allowed you to get some limelight in the WWE and get an opportunity there. So how did that come about? Was it just a few years in the indies and someone from the WWE saw you and pulled you up from your work? Or did you know someone based on your experience working in the indies? How did you get a WWE opportunity? I believe it was 98-ish that you start working for the WWE. How'd that come about?
Okay, well, I knew a couple different people. First of all, one of them was Victor Quinones, who was a promoter and wrestling manager out of Puerto Rico. He was involved with Carlos Colon's company, the WWC, down in Puerto Rico. And he was also sort of a talent liaison for the WWE between the WWE and a lot of Mexican and Japanese wrestlers around the time that they tried to do the light heavyweights division. So that period of time where you had Negro Casas coming in and Taka Michinoku and Sho Funaki, like that was all through efforts that were facilitated by Victor Quinones. So Victor Quinones knew of me from I had a short stint in Puerto Rico in 1995. And he knew of me through there. And my tag team partner at the time, whose name was Kevin Quinn, Kevin got to know Victor after working in Mexico, I want to say in CMLL. And so Victor and Kevin got to be very good friends. And there was a period of time where when Victor was helping Taka in the WWF, there was a period of time where they came to the West Coast, actually towards Phoenix, and they had television. And they needed someone to wrestle Taka Michinoku. And so Victor knew me through Kevin and from Puerto Rico, and he gave me the opportunity to wrestle Taka Michinoku on Shotgun Saturday Night in 1998. And so that particular match gave me a lot of publicity. It gave me a lot of people who became aware of my work. And so that particular match did two things for me. First of all, it got me acquainted with Taka, which helped me get booked Pan a year later. And then it also got me in front of people like Jim Cornette, and that helped me get booked in the WWF, the dojos that Dory Funk Jr. was running at the time. It got me invited to one of those, and because of that, that got me in front of people like Jim Kettner, who ran the ECWA, who also was the mind behind the Super 8 tournament, and I got booked for Jim and working with the ECWA and the Super 8 tournament. And that sort of opened the doors for me in the Northeast independent scene, which is where the independent scene in the United States was strongest. And so once I got booked over there, it got me in front of a lot of different promoters, and it got me on the radar of a lot of different independent wrestling promoters. So getting booked over in Japan and then getting booked in the Northeast, those were the two avenues that really opened up for me as a result of that match with Taka.
Wow, that's great. And so, yeah, so you had some work on Shotgun Saturday Night, which was one of the WWE failed projects, unfortunately. I live here in Ohio, and I always wanted to see Shotgun Saturday Night, but every time I would go, like, to Cincinnati and, like, you know, stay there for a weekend or something, I would see Shotgun or Dayton. But we never had it in Columbus. But it was one of those things, kind of like the XFL. It's just one of those things that, although it was quote unquote a failed project, it would always be talked about because, you know, Shotgun Saturday Night was home to a lot of. It was an interesting concept, first of all, and then it was home to just a lot of things, a lot of memorable angles, not necessarily angles, but just different moments. But even that allowed you to get a more of a television role, not on air as yourself, but you became Dos, correct? One of the conquistadors. The other version.
Right. Because I did that particular match, that got me sort of involved with WWE. So when they came to the West Coast, when they came within driving distance, I was usually used as one of the extras, as one some of the enhancement talent then. So I got a chance to work with a lot of different guys like Shokunaki and Dick Togo and Draz and R-Truth. And I did a couple dark matches as well with guys like Jeff Hardy. And so when they needed people to do that particular angle, Edge and Christian and the Hardy Boys, and, you know, sort of throw in the Conquistadors in the mix, they used me for that as well. And, unfortunately, it wasn't a position where I was wrestling, but I did a lot of the backstage stuff with Edge and Christian, and that was my first interaction with Edge and Christian. And to this day, they're still very friendly and very cool with me. So it was a good little circumstance for me to be able to work with those guys back then.
Yeah, that's great. And that was really at the height of their team, you know, as Edge and Christian. So it was pretty interesting. So with your experience on Shotgun, with the Conquistadors angle, it seemed as if there was more of a promise with you in WWE. What happened there as far as the reason why you didn't keep a lasting relationship with the WWE? Was it, you know, people not finding an angle for you? Was it something that you did? What happened? What caused the separation?
the funny thing is, no one ever really said anything. Like, no one has ever came out and said, first of all, they never really came out and said, hey, we're looking at you for a long-term position, so this is your opportunity. And then they also never said, oh, we were looking at you for a long-term possibility, but that's gone now. It was just like whenever they were around, I was available, and I worked, and I got good responses from the people that watched me work. But they never, I guess they never really saw anything that they could sink their teeth into, which was fine. I mean, I made myself available to them, but they never really offered to take it any farther after I did the dojo with them. They just kept in touch, and I tried, you know, numerous times for dark matches and things like that, and it just never worked out. So, I wish I could tell you there was one thing that was the reason, but there really wasn't. And so often, like, no one really says a whole lot of these things, too. It's like, a lot of times things just sort of never materialize, and no one ever really says, oh, this is what you're doing wrong, this is what you could have done, you should have done. Things go, and then, you know, circumstances just dictate that you're in a different position or in a different location than where you thought you would be after, you know, all the stuff that I ended up doing with it.
Yeah, it's just interesting. Knowing your work, knowing your body of work, I've watched you. I remember the Conquistadors thing, but I don't know when was it that I first started watching your work. There was a rare ECW match that you had against Rhino. You remember that?
Yes, I do.
So
yeah, that was actually his debut in the arena. Was Rhino. And that was another situation where I had talked to Paul, and Paul had brought me in, and I did like 2 weeks with them, and I talked to him afterwards, and he was like, "Yeah, we're gonna do this with you and this with you," and in that period of time too, like after I had that discussion with him, I never went back, and I think a lot of that was just a matter of, you know, me living on the West Coast and flying me back and forth to where their shows were. Just monetarily didn't make a whole lot of sense. So that's, you know, that was another situation where no one ever really said, oh, this is what happened. I know that I was working there, and then I stopped working there, and, you know, it just went that way.
Yeah. And you had hair then too. You just weren't yourself.
I did have hair. Probably some of the worst hair in wrestling, which is probably the best that I went bald anyway.
Yeah, the bald look is definitely you. So, how did the Fallen Angel gimmick come about, and what's the whole meaning? Like, explain to people just in case they don't know what the Fallen Angel gimmick comes from, and what's the meaning behind that. When did it come about, and what does it mean?
Okay, well, first of all, my first like many young wrestlers do. I started out as a babyface, and I was just Christopher Daniels. I was Christopher Daniels from day one. And so I was working in Windy City Wrestling, and I was a babyface. And after a while, I pitched an idea to Sam DeCero about turning heel. And I had a partner at that point, Kevin Quinn, who went with me to Puerto Rico a couple years later. But we were looking for a name for our tag team. And I came up with the Fallen Angels, and Kevin wasn't really up with that one. So, but I decided I really liked the name, and so I decided to keep that name for myself. And really, the whole impetus behind that name for me then was just the idea that I was a good guy, and now I'm a bad guy, and so I was a Fallen Angel. And that name sort of stuck with me throughout, like when I left Windy City and went abroad. I took it with me, and so I was the Fallen Angel everywhere I went. It wasn't until a couple years later that I decided to sort of, like, put a look to the name. And, like, one of the things that sort of made me want to do that was watching Goldust wrestle. Because when he started his whole character in the WWF, I thought he was very polarizing. You know, it was something that everybody sort of had strong feelings about, whether they lived in the north or the south, or whether they were white or black or or whatever their background was, you know, I found that they had a really strong sense of their own sexuality. And so Goldust was pushing those buttons. And I thought that was a brilliant move for him to sort of push those buttons. It got everybody sort of riled up. And so I thought to myself, well, what would be another, I guess, hot button for people to sort of get upset about? And in my head, my answer was religion. And so I decided to become a guy who thought he was God, a guy who thought he was God's chosen guy, and a guy that would go out and say, you know, God doesn't love you. He loves me. I'm his chosen and you're not his chosen, and sort of put myself above everyone else in that respect. And so it wasn't soon after that that I decided to get a priest robe and wear that to the ring and sort of religious jargon in my promos to sort of put over the idea that I was this preacher type person who thought he was God's vessel on earth, and that God was, you know, back in his play throughout, and everybody that was against him, you know, God hated them and loved me. And so that was sort of the character. And I did that character through the independent scene for a very long time.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, being a very religious guy myself, I understood the fallen angel reference, but the backstory of it makes it even more intriguing. That's really cool. So, you had a stint in WCW as well. So, a lot of people don't know that. And you there were some ideas thrown around as far as what they wanted to do with you, but again, like ECW and WWE, it kind of never came to pass. So let us know your experience in WCW.
Well, first of all, I don't know if everybody knows this, but I actually had two different stints in WCW. The first one started in the beginning of 2000. I had a dark match in Los Angeles here, and it wasn't soon after that Kevin Sullivan, who was booking at the time, he offered me a contract. And so I accepted, and I was set to debut in the middle, I want to say April 5th. And all I had to do was finish one last tour of Japan. And so I was in Japan, and while I was in Japan, I read the news that Kevin Sullivan had been let go, and in his place were Vince Russo and Eric Bischoff. And so the day I was supposed to debut with Kevin Sullivan ended up being the day that, and I want to say this is in Denver, Colorado, where Vince and Eric started the show and basically reset everything. They gave the belts to
their guys.
Yeah, they stripped the titles. That was supposed to be my debut under Kevin Sullivan. And so I came back from Japan, and first thing I did was I called WCW, and, you know, I was like, am I fired? Am I gone? And they're like, no, your job's with us. Your job's not with Kevin Sullivan. Your job's with us, so just wait. And we'll call you when we're ready for you. And so I waited a little while, and finally they called me, and they asked me to come to a Nitro that was in Atlanta. And so I met with Vince Russo and talked to him about some ideas. And they had an idea previous. I guess the gentleman that came up with the idea was still there after Kevin left. And they had the idea that I was going to be Vampiro's superior. They wanted me to sort of be, and they described it to me as if Vampiro was Darth Vader, they wanted me to be the Emperor. Hmm. And so they filmed one vignette with me and Vampiro. And I remember being in the locker room, like I remember filming it. And then later they aired it on Nitro while I was in the locker room. And I just heard a bunch of like, what the hell? And who's that guy? And all that. And I was like, okay, well, that didn't go as well as I think they wanted. And that was the last time they did anything with it. So, and no one really said to me, oh, we should have done that different, or you should have done anything different. Like, I gave them what I thought they wanted, and that was the last I ever did of it. And so I continued to travel with WCW for a couple months, and then I stopped traveling with them and was just waiting at home. And then finally I got called and said, you know, you're making too much money for the amount that we're using you. And I said, in response, I'm willing to wrestle, so you can always use me. They're like, no, we're going to let you go at this point. So they let me go, And a couple months later, Terry Taylor called me and said, hey, we have an opportunity for you again to be on Nitro, and we're going to do this thing with you. And so I went out and had the match with Mike Modest on Nitro, and this was January 2001. And I got signed after that, but I was signed under a developmental deal. And they had done the angle right after that where Scott Steiner broke my leg and broke Mike Modest's leg, because the night before he had broken Sid Vicious broke his leg. And so they were doing a thing where Scott Steiner was breaking everybody's leg. And so they broke our legs and they said, okay, you're off healing. And when you come back, we'll do something with you. And it was a couple months later that WWF bought them and WCW closed. So that was the end of my second WCW stint.
Man, that's just crazy to me, because it just seems, I mean, now you've definitely cemented yourself as being just, you know, world renowned, but it just seems like you were almost there. Something happened that just caused a big halting stop on these opportunities. It's just crazy, you know. And of course, you know, fate and just purpose, and you're supposed to be here and things like that, you know, those can all come to play, but it's just crazy that those times in the WWE and ECW and WCW, you know, were caused or were stopped by just something outside of your control. It's not like you were a drug head and blew the opportunity. It just, you know, it just didn't go about. But I mean, you rebounded. You rebounded career for sure. You were saying,
yeah, I you know, for all of those things that didn't happen, I still kept at it, and you know, opportunities soon came around. You know, after 2001, when WCW closed and WWF didn't renew my contract or didn't pick me up, you know, it was tough for a while to sort of see what was going to happen. And then it wasn't until 2002 that Ring of Honor started and TNA started. And from there, I was pretty much entrenched with both of those companies off and on since then.
Yeah. You did some work in Japan before then, right? Before your ROH run?
Well, yeah, definitely. I started in 99 in Japan for Michinoku Pro. And my second tour was the tour that I started doing the Curry Man gimmick. And that got popular enough with Michinoku Pro that they brought me back pretty much every tour from 99 until 2000 and the middle of 2000 when I signed my first WCW contract. And then when I got let go, I returned to Michinoku and was touring with them. And because of that, that got me involved with New Japan. The character got invited to do the Super Juniors, the Best of the Super Juniors tournament. And my first tour with them, they offered me an opportunity to return. And after a couple tours, I asked if I could be full-time with, or not full-time, but sort of exclusive with them. And so I stopped doing Michinoku and started doing New Japan. And from like 2002 to 2004, I was doing, you know, pretty frequently touring with New Japan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But like you said, ROH is when you really, ROH and TNA is what's when you really started to become just the name that you are. Your stint with the Prophecy and Ring of Honor. And you were in the first show, right? Low-key won the title, if I'm not mistaken.
Not in the first show. The first show was myself and Bryan Danielson and low-key in the main event. It wasn't until a couple months later that they had the tournament, and then
the round robin.
The end of the tournament was the and then the end of the tournament was 1 hour four-way match that it was me and low-key and Doug Williams and Spanky.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's right.
Do lie. It was June or July of 2002 that they did the finals of that tournament.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and low key won, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and that's what really, I mean, puts you on a map as a main player in Ring of Honor. So, explain your let us know about your early days in Ring of Honor and how you got that opportunity, and just some people who you got to, who you didn't wrestle before, who you really got to have some great matches with back then.
Well, the Ring of Honor thing came about because the people that ran it at that time, Rob Feinstein, Gabe Sapolsky, they had seen the end of ECW in the Northeast area, and they noticed, they knew that there was a market for that hardcore wrestling fan. And so they decided, you know, based on the King of Indies tournament that All Pro Wrestling had out on the West Coast, that was based in part on the Super 8 tournament from ECWA, they saw that they could get these super shows made up of a lot of this independent talent that hadn't been brought up to WWE, that, you know, 2 years earlier might have been working for WCW or might have been working for ECW, but now that there wasn't a place for them to work, they decided to do their own shows. And so at first, I just, you know, you don't know at the time that it's going to become a fixture in professional wrestling. At that point, I was, okay, this is a show. They call it Ring of Honor. Okay, this is a great show. And you look around the locker room, there's a lot of great talent there. And, you know, they brought Eddie Guerrero in to wrestle Super Crazy. And when we got there, we assumed that that was going to be the main event. And we got there and Gabe said, no, you guys are the main event. Myself and Low Key and Brian Danielson in a three-way. And I look back at that and understand now that Gabe didn't want to, I guess, put the name of Ring of Honor. He wanted Ring of Honor not to be looked at as a place where, I guess, people who had already made their name were going to perform. He wanted guys to make their names in Ring of Honor, and so he gave us that opportunity to be the main event. And, you know, I still think that match sort of stands up in terms of some of the best three-ways in the history of wrestling. You know, that match a lot of people still talk about, you know, 13 years later.
Yeah. That three-way, and I think probably what people would vote the best three-way would be the one with you, Joe, and AJ for TNA. That one was incredible. I watched that many times. So Triple X with TNA, a Russo thing, I'd imagine, because he was the leader of the Sports Entertainment Extreme.
How
did that come about in the production meeting? I know that Russo was just a man of many cartoonish thoughts, and you know he's really big into characters, which I can actually respect. But how did Sex come about, and then Triple X? I know that he wanted to be very edgy, and the beginning of TNA. I remember watching the very beginning of TNA and just the pole dancers and just the whole TNA kind of doublespeak and just that type of edginess. But it worked for you in Elix and Low Key, interestingly enough, as far as that trio that you guys had. It was an amazing trio, and it actually really worked for y'all to put your names on the map. And then of course the feud that y'all had with AMW, it was absolutely amazing. So how did that come about as far as Vince Russo choosing you three to become Triple X, and what were your overall thoughts on that time in TNA?
Well, I don't really know, like I can't really speak on Vince's mentality in terms of the Sports Entertainment Extreme. I wasn't really privy to a lot of that stuff. All I can tell you about Triple X was I think that Vince saw that the X Division was becoming an integral part of TNA at that point. Like Triple X didn't start until December of 2002. So from June until December, I think a lot of the focus went into the X Division, and that had a lot to do with guys like AJ Styles and Jerry Lynn and Low Ki, who was there previous to me being there. You know, all of these guys that were putting on these matches, you know, because we were on pay-per-view every week, I think the thing that was really going around was a real strong word of mouth about the matches that were going on TNA pay-per-views at that point. So I believe the mentality for us as Triple X, especially myself and Low Ki, at that point, all three of us were working pretty frequently in Japan. I was doing stuff with Michinoku in New Japan. Low Ki was doing stuff through 01. And I want to say Elix was doing all Japan at the time. And so the mentality was they wanted to put a group of X Division wrestlers together, but they wanted to also, you know, because they weren't doing full-time contracts at that point, they also wanted to sort of be flexible in terms of scheduling. And so the mentality was the three of us, all three of us wouldn't be on tour at the same time for the three different companies. So they wanted they wanted us to be a presence. Whether one of us was on tour or not, the other two guys would be there. And so they were sort of playing the Freebird rules with us, but not just on television, but also like with our situations with Japan. And so the idea was put us together as a trio, and then when one of us had to go overseas, the other two would be there to sort of Triple X while the third guy was off. And so that was the mentality, and we got a lot of opportunities early on when they put us together. I feel like Vince saw that there was good chemistry between the three of us. And I honestly think, you know, Vince had a relationship with Elix Kipper from WCW, and he had already seen a lot from Low Ki in the 6 months that he had been there. I got added, and I think, like, in Vince's eyes, I was the third of the three, like the lower guy out of the trio, which was fine. I mean, I understood that, you know, like I said, he knew Elix, he had been watching Low Ki for the last, and I had something to prove. So I felt like going in there, there was a lot of opportunity for me to sort of put myself out there. And I thought I did a really good job of, and I think the three of us actually did a really good job of not making any one of us stand out more than the other. We looked like a team. We acted as a team. No one guy ever took the focus more than anyone else. And I think that really lent a lot to us becoming a strong tandem. And then once Low Ki, there was a period of time where Low Ki was really injured. And so at that point, that was when Elix and I really became strong as just the tag team. And that's what led to us being just just the two of us at that point. After a while, Low Ki sort of, they stopped using him as much as they did, and they just focused on Elix and myself as the team.
Yeah. And y'all had some incredible matches against America's Most Wanted, including that infamous cage match when Elix did that tightrope Hurricane Rana. Yikes. And you were holding the person. You were kind of, you're kind of balancing, you kind of pushed the person off just as he were doing it. Was it, who was it that took the bump? Was it
Chris
Storm?
Harris. Chris Harris.
Oh, was it? Okay. Well, okay. Chris Harris. Yeah. Yeah. So what were your thoughts as Elix Skipper was doing the tightrope on the cage? And I mean, he took probably half a dozen steps at least. And I mean, were you, I know that you've seen so many things, and that had to be really a first in many people's eyes. What were your thoughts as far as while he was walking that cage, like, you know, please don't fall. Was it one of those things, or was it, just having so much confidence? Yeah, I'd imagine.
Confident thing, like Elix used to do that on the ring ropes all the time. Like he would stand on the buckle and he would walk the middle of the rope, like you walk to the middle of the ring on the top rope. And, you know, we both thought, the top of the cage is at least solid. It's not swaying back and forth like a rope. So, you know, in Elix's mind, he had no doubt that he could do it. And I told him, like, you know, I felt confident that he could do it as well. But, of course, at the same time, we also had a backup plan in case it didn't go the way it was supposed to go. Okay. But, you know, as it's happening, And once he made those steps, I realized that he was going to make it. And, you know, that was his opportunity to sort of make history. And that stands out. I mean, I think, like you said, it's the memorable part of that particular match. Like, I don't think anybody else remembers anything else about it other than it was a really good match. So, I mean, he sort of cemented his place in history.
Yeah, it was one of the best spots I've ever seen in my life. That's for sure. So you had some success in TNA, had some ins and outs, and what happened as far as your from a contractual standpoint, because you were in TNA and then you went away, and I remember you went back to ROH and just kind of help initiate the television championship. I remember watching you, and I think Eddie Edwards had a fantastic match when it was on HDNet. But it was kind of an in and out thing. You came in and then you had another gimmick where you had the paint on the face, kind of an edgier type move. You were, I think at that time you were more of a heavyweight. You were seen more of a heavyweight than you were a cruiserweight, and you also had an opportunity to have an angle with Sting. So, you know, that's incredible too. So why the in and out? Was it, we don't have anything for you right now, we'll call you type thing? Or what caused the inconsistency of staying through TNA?
Well, the timeline ended up going like this. I started doing the stuff with Sting, and that was the period of time where I had the face paint. It was an angle that Vince Russo had come up with. And for some reason, I felt like they never really pulled the trigger on it. Like, they had me talking about doing stuff with Sting, and they had me interacting with stuff with Sting. But I felt like they were still doing other things with Sting that never made me the focus of Sting's attention. And so I always felt like, you know, by making me seem like I wasn't the most important thing on Sting's plate, that it sort of hurt me. Like, it made me look like I wasn't important enough for the fans to care about either. And so after that, that was the end of the whole Fallen Angel character with me, just because I felt like it wasn't working. Like, I felt like I had gone as far as I could go in TNA with that mentality and that style of promo. And so I pitched the idea of doing Curry Man with them. And so they gave me a year where I was doing Curry Man as a character. And at the end of that, they got rid of the Curry Man character. They fired him. And I came back for a short period of time, first as Suicide, because the person that was doing Suicide got injured right away. And so I took his place for a couple months. And then I was back to doing myself. I was back to being myself. And, and then just near the end or near the beginning of 2010, they basically let me go. They said they didn't really have anything for me. And so they were going in a different direction. So I went to Ring of Honor around the beginning of 2010. And I was actually, the stuff you were talking about with Eddie Edwards was actually the first television champion, but I was his first real angle. Mm-hmm. And I was the guy that defeated him for the belt. And I had a good couple months, maybe 6 months as television champion. But what had happened was there was a big upheaval in TNA, and they had to change some plans. And so when those plans changed, one of the things that happened was AJ Styles and the rest of Fortune turned babyface. And so they did an angle between AJ and Bully Ray, and someone mentioned that when AJ got hurt, like they did an angle where AJ was hurt, they mentioned that me coming back would be a reasonable happening. And so they called me and they asked me to come back. And so at the time, Ring of Honor allowed me to go back, and TNA allowed me to finish up my Ring of Honor contract. So for a short period of time, I was doing Ring of Honor and TNA, and I was very fortunate that both companies sort of let me do that. So I had some really good matches on my way out of Ring of Honor, some great stuff with Eddie Edwards, some great stuff with Colt Cabana, and then finally losing the championship to El Generico. Like, those were some great matches. I was real proud of my work as the television champion for Ring of Honor. And then, like, right after that, like, I got in with Fortune and was doing the stuff between Fortune and Immortal. And then soon after that, AJ and I sort of had our falling out where I sort of turned the corner and became heel again. And that sort of led to the Bad Influence team with Frankie.
Yeah, which is, it just seems like greatness just fell together. I mean, it's interesting. Now, how much, let me ask you this. How often did you tag with Frankie, you know, in indies or anything like that? Did you have a history tagging with him, or did it just kind of fall into place?
No, we never tagged. We might have tagged once or twice on Independence or in TNA, off and on. But, like, when we started as the team, we were just friends. I mean, he and I have been traveling together for many years before we became tag team partners. He's a Southern California guy like myself. When I moved out here, it wasn't too long after that he started training. He trained in Massachusetts with Killer Kowalski, but he's always been a Southern California guy. And so when he moved back here, he worked out at the School of Hard Knocks, which was Bill Anderson and Jesse Hernandez school here in San Bernardino. And that's where I was going to practice and train and do stuff. And so we've been friends for a very long time. And then once TNA started and we both were on the TNA roster for a good long while, we were always on the same flights. We were always in the car together. And so we just became friends. And so the Bad Influence team came around because at that point in TNA, the Motor City Machine Guns had split up because they were going through injuries, and then they had just split up Beer Money. They just started doing the storyline with Bobby Roode turning against James Storm. And so I knew that they didn't really have any plans for me as a singles, and Frankie sort of thought that same way. So we got together and we said, you know, we could put our efforts into being a marquee tag team and be the next Beer Money or the next Motor City Machine Guns for this company. And so that was what we offered to TNA, and they came back to us with the angle between and AJ Styles, and it ended up being the thing with Claire Lynch. Sort of cemented me and Frankie as the tag team.
That was interesting because Frankie was reluctant for a while, and then he just kind of caved in, and the both of you. I mean, it was great. I mean, just the chemistry, you can tell, you know, you can tell when something's organic and when it has just a real feel to it, rather just putting two people together and hopefully that it sticks. I mean, you can tell that it was just meant to be that you and Frankie tag team, and you had that organic feel as if y'all knew each other as the old, you know, tag teams, the Hart Foundations and the Rockers. They knew each other so well that they could, you know, accentuate each other's, you know, high spots and strengths. And I can tell even now with NROH that, you know, Bad Influence and now the Addiction, that we see that. And just real quick, why don't y'all have the Sexy Beast theme song anymore? I love that theme song. I know the Worship, you know, Worship Us Now or whatever, that I understand it fits more to your character, but Is it because you guys turn heel that y'all don't have that theme song no more? I think that was probably one of the coolest theme songs.
That's absolutely it, man. We changed our attitude, and so we changed everything, our look, our style. We sort of turned the corner and wanted to embrace full-on being heels. And one of the things that, to me, it just means you don't give the fans a reason to like you. If you do,
no, I agree.
You're sort of working against the grain. And so we decided, like, a lot of people love that song, and that song by Cushionator, Sexy Beast, was a great song. And but I knew that if we kept that song, or if we kept that style of entrance where we were sort of bebopping down the aisle like I used to be, like, people would get behind it. And so I realized that I had to go against that grain, and I didn't want to be liked. I wanted people to not like me. And so I changed the look. I changed the gear. I got the full-on military jacket made to look like the ring general. And that was the mentality, was to sort of go against people's likes.
I love it.
And so that's what we're working toward.
I see, I can go on, and we're going to wrap up here in a minute, but I can go on and on about that and how much I appreciate a wrestler appreciating still the character of a heel. And I love it. Your points, if it matters at all, your points, your Chris Featherstone points just increased exponentially with that statement.
Well,
because I think I write so much about it. Just why is pro wrestling losing so many viewers? I think because people want to get over for their wrestling skills more than their character. And I think we're missing that. We're missing heels being heels and wanting to be heels. And I love you go ahead.
Well, I was going to say part of that, I think part of the problem is that pro wrestling has changed so much and people are so much more aware of the goings on behind the scenes and they're so much more involved that it's hard for people to establish a character that is believable as someone that you don't want to like. Because the line between the character and the real wrestler are often blurred, it's tough for guys to go out there and actually truly be hated. Just because I think people, the average wrestling fan sort of knows what the gig is too. So even in their best, like even you, Chris, someone watching our stuff, like, you appreciate how hard we're working to be the bad guy, but you also realize that we're working to be the bad guy and not, you know what I mean? Like, we're not actually kicking children as we walk to our house,
right?
Or, you know what I mean? Or, you know, we're not spitting in the punch bowl at the Christmas. Like, it's tough to fudge that line between the character that you are and the person that you are. And that's the difficulty I feel in today's professional wrestling, is that everybody's so micromanaged and under the microscope. Like, the fans and the rest of the world, they see every aspect of your life. And so to sort of fool them into thinking that you are actually the bad person that you're trying to portray on television, that's a chore, man. It's very tough. And so, like, we do our very best for people to forget that we're real people the minute they come in and watch the show. We want them to sort of suspend that disbelief and get angry at us for what we're doing in the building and in the context of professional wrestling. It's just hard for people to let that go and not try to analyze and evaluate every little thing that you do.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think the problem, though, as from a fan standpoint, is they're trying, so many fans, and I've written hundreds of articles on Bleacher Report and Sports Illustrated and WAWNation.com and other big websites that I used to write for. It's like I spend time to just go through all the hundreds of thousands of comments that people have had on my articles. And one of the biggest takeaways that I've noticed is that people are unfairly bringing too much reality in wrestling, if you understand what I'm saying. And I don't like that. I think that's a dangerous, slippery slope, because I think wrestling became wrestling because Dusty Rhodes and Ric Flair and, you know, people, Hulk Hogan, they were larger than life characters, and people suspended reality to invest in this person's character. They didn't care about, you know, them. They didn't care about anything about them outside of the arena. Nothing. And I think that that's what popularized pro wrestling so much,
And I think the problem now is that people actually care about the tweets and the Facebook mess posts and, you know, the Instagram pictures and things like that. The person in the character is kind of tying in with the real person. And I think that that's right. kind of causing an issue. And I respect people like you, because when you're a heel, you're a heel. And I remember when I was I went to an ROH show in Ohio, my hometown, and you were there. And it was so funny because I literally chuckled because you stayed in your character, because I was in a spot where I could see you sit all the way in the back. You were at a chair. You were in a chair sitting watching the rest of the matches. I think it was y'all against the Briscoes, if I'm not mistaken. And after that, you sat down in the back, way in the back, and people were coming to you, and you were still staying in character, and you weren't really saying much to them. You were kind of like, you know, hey, you know, I'm focused on this match here, and it seemed kind of jerkish a little bit. But I appreciate it because, again, when you're in that arena, you're in that arena. You are just consumed in the character of Christopher Daniels or whomever heel you insert there, or whomever babyface insert there. And I think that's the issue with modern day wrestling, that people just don't really want to admit. Like, we have to, when we're in the arena, when we're watching that screen, it's welcome to our world. It's an entirely different world for us professional wrestling fans and wrestlers that we all just need to embrace and not, you know, not blur the line when we go out the arena. So I definitely give you kudos for that. So,
well, thank you.
Oh, absolutely. And wrapping it up, is there any talks? Have you had any talks within past years? You know, NXT is starting to just erupt. And has there been any talks to bring Christopher Daniels in the WWE in the past couple of years?
Not really. I think my best time for them, at least in their eyes, was the period of time when I was under contract with TNA. So I feel like, you know, even though I could conceivably go there and you know, possibly thrive, I think to them, at my age, I'm probably past the point of being a valid investment to them, which is fine. I mean, I don't have anything to prove, and they certainly don't. Their business doesn't hinge on whether or not I sign with them either. So I feel like we're both probably fine where we are. And honestly, the last year or two with Ring of Honor has shown me how much Ring of Honor has meant to me in my career, and I feel a very strong loyalty to them at this point. So, I mean, yeah. I'm not really looking to go anywhere else. I mean, Ring of Honor has been very good to me at this point, and I want to continue to help the company, not just by being in the ring, but by being someone behind the scenes that can sort of help guide and direct the product towards positive growth. And if I can do that, then I feel like I'm doing something not just for Christopher Daniels, the career of Christopher Daniels, but for Ring of Honor as a company, as a whole, as a product. If I can do that, then I'm certainly doing more than I could. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I can respect that, certainly. It's just that we've seen James Storm come, we've seen Joe come, and they've both, especially Joe, especially with the NXT London event, just an incredible match. And Joe and Storm coming in, two people who you've had great feuds with in TNA, they came and made a presence in NXT. And then, I don't know, to me, I just see you as that trainer on Breaking Ground on the WWE Network. I see you as that player coach, so to speak, having a couple of matches
honestly,
on NXT.
I feel like there are a lot of guys that are on the – not independent team, but I mean, guys through TNA, guys that I've known in the last, you know, 10, 20 years that could fit that role very well. And it just so happens that, you know, like Joe, the timing of Joe's departure from TNA was very good in the sense that NXT started looking at people outside of their own backyard in terms of like people that they were building from the bottom up. They saw someone like Joe who had that worldwide experience, and Joe has put it to good use. They gave him the opportunity and said, you know, let's see what happens when we take a guy like Joe or like Finn Balor or Kevin Owens, like these guys that have had worldwide experience outside of the WWE, let's put them in the WWE system and see what happens. And look at Kevin Owens now. Look at Joe now. Look at Finn Balor now. Like, they've done amazingly well. And so I think that those three examples certainly lends someone like James Storm an opportunity where he might not have had that opportunity 2 years prior. So, I mean, just the timing of Joe leaving was good for Joe, and it worked out good for him. And that probably will open doors for people in the future to get an opportunity where, you know, many years ago they might not have looked at someone with 10 years independent wrestling experience as a viable candidate for a roster spot. So, I mean, coming back to my particular example, like, if they had had that mindset maybe 5 years ago, that might have been me, you know, when I left TNA in 2010. If NXT was in the position it is now, that might have been a spot that I might have been able to do. But the timing of it was just different for me. And so it ended up where, you know, going back to Ring of Honor and reestablishing that bond and then doing that same thing 2 years ago has led to a much stronger relationship between me and Ring of Honor, and one that I continue to pursue and continue to grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that makes sense, and I can totally see that. Last question to you is, why in the world were you never world champion in TNA or ROH? Was it ever discussed? That is the age-old question in my mind, and we're getting a bunch of live comments here right now, and I saw that pop up a few times too. Why were you never world champion? What happened?
Those are all discussions that you should have when you interview Gabe Sapolsky and Vince Russo. And, you know, I'm sure it was discussed at certain points with certain people, but, like, as to why or why not, it's not really my question to answer. I felt that there were opportunities, but, you know, for whatever reason, it wasn't the right business move for those opportunities. You know, so, I mean, that's the way it is. It's not always... It certainly isn't up to the person himself. You know, these are decisions that are made by people higher than me. And so all I can do is make it viable and worthwhile to do. And if they decide to do it, then they do. And if they don't, I'm still where I'm at. I've still done what I've done. And if I never get to be world champion, I still consider myself very successful, especially in the grand scheme of things. I feel like I've done a lot more than I might have thought I was going to do when I started doing this in 1993.
Yeah. Yeah. Great point. Yeah. I'm not giving up on you, man. If Jerry Lynn,
I'm not giving up either. I haven't stopped yet. I'm not going to. So,
yeah, I believe you.
There's still time. Believe me.
That's true. If Jerry Lynn can win an ROH World Championship later in his career, so can you. And I guess the question to you is how long do you think you have left?
I'm honest with myself to know that I'm pretty close to the end of it now. But at the same time, I realize that the end of this can be 3, 5, 7 years from now. A lot of it has to do with how I'm feeling physically, and right now I feel great. And a lot of it has to do with how I'm feeling creatively. And Ring of Honor has been outstanding in that respect, working with me and doing the stuff that we've been doing the last couple of years. And I have total faith in Ring of Honor in the creative side that, you know, if I had ideas, they would be receptive to them. They might not always do them, but at the same time, they'll at least give me the opportunity to say this or that or however I feel. And, you know, and when you have that creative freedom to go in and speak your mind and sort of pitch ideas of yours, I think that it's better overall. I mean, as long as viable options are considered and weighed, it's a positive thing overall. And so for me, that's one of the things that keeps me going too, is knowing that I've got a company that respects my opinion and is willing to listen to me and give me, you know, my time in the light to sort of speak my mind or pitch my idea or whatever it is. And as long as I'm working with these guys, I'm going to give them every effort to continue to be a force inside the ring and out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've interviewed legends, I've interviewed world champions, but I've only been interviewed one fallen angel. So I appreciate your time, Chris.
You're welcome, man. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. And let me take this opportunity to say thank you to your fan base for listening. If it wasn't for those guys, the real fans of pro wrestling, none of us would be where we are today if it wasn't for their support. So I sincerely say thank you to all of you guys listening tonight. I appreciate it.
Totally agree with you. I greatly appreciate it. Plug yourself right quick. Social media and upcoming events.
Okay. Well, you can see me on Twitter at FAC Daniels. You can catch me on Ring of Honor television every week, Wednesday nights on Comet or on their syndicated network. You can go to ROHWrestling.com to check local listings to see where we are on in your area. And that's pretty much it, man. I mean, everything that I got going on, I usually pitch through Twitter. So just keep an eye on my Twitter feed, and I'll let you know where I'm going to be in the coming months. And we'll see how it goes from there. Just show up with me.
Awesome. It's been a pleasure, sir. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much, and happy holidays.
You too. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
You are now listening to the Pancakes and Power Slam Show, hosted by Chris Featherstone and Derek of Crave Wrestling. This is the new Tuesday Night Titans.
Ladies and gentlemen, the fallen angel Christopher Daniels. As soon as I think that I couldn't have a better interview here in the string of interviews of Pancakes and Power Slams, it happens again, Derek.
It happens again. It's going to continue to happen. This is what happens on Tuesday nights at Pancakes and Power Slam. So, obviously, Chris, it's going to keep going. 10 minutes is never enough. That's about all the time we have tonight. But, mm-hmm. I mean, the interview that you had with Christopher Daniels on We Are Wrestling just distinguishes who we are. This is wrestling at its best. Tuesday nights, forget Monday Night Raw. Tuesday night's where you need to be. We've got everything that makes sense in the world of pro wrestling.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's just, this overall view of the Slammies, we're going to talk about that, and then let's spend probably 90 seconds on that, and then we're going to talk about the Flavor of the Week, the number 30 entrance from 94 to 99 real quick. The winners, Taker and Brock wins the match of the year. This is awesome. Goes to Ronda and Rock at WrestleMania. Nikki Bella gets the Diva of the Year. Sting gets the Surprise Return of the Year, which I was actually happy about. Hero in All of Us Award, John Cena. Superstar of the Year goes to Seth Rollins. Shocking moment was Kalisto's Toledo El Sol. R-Truth gets the LOL moment of the year, which is actually really funny. That was I literally cracked up laughing when that happened during the Money in the Bank. Neville gets the Breakout Star of the Year, which I was thinking like it may have been rigged, the votes. But then seeing how he was just completely brushed off it was like, you know what, this may not have been rigged. Robert Rhea goes to Taker and Brock. Stone Cold Podcast gets the best original WWE Network. Double Cross of the Year was Miz Dow. Good to see him. Extreme Moment of the Year was Reigns and the whole Triple H thing at TLC. Tag Team of the Year was the Usos. I like the Usos, but this was a horrible choice. The New Day was certainly the best tag team. And then the best John Cena U.S. Open Challenge. Why is that an award, first of all? But the one with Cesaro is the one that won, which rightfully so. And then, there's not much to talk about with Raw. It just you spend so much time in making Roman Reigns somebody, and then you just have it just thrown away with just smiley face Reigns again, and the WWE they just cannot stay consistent with developing the character Roman Reigns, and just it's absolutely horrible to see that with. And then Triple H getting beat up and then coming back 3 days later on NXT and, you know, barely saying he, you know, mentioning something. They're sabotaging the character of Roman Reigns by having Stephanie and Triple H just being inconsistent with selling. It's just it's really painful to watch their failure of developing stars.
They've got nothing for that. And it's last night, Stephanie McMahon just screaming, yelling, "Get out of my ring, get out of my ring, get out of my building." And yeah. He just stands there and smiles. I was bored. It was so boring. Horrible, horrible start to Raw. The Slammies itself is a joke. It always has been. I mean, go back and watch on WWE Network, the 1987 Slammies. I mean, the thing was just an absolute massacre. And the best moment of last night, like you said, R-Truth stole the night. With showing his Money in the Bank moment, which I almost forgot about. I'm glad they showed it again because I had to rewind it and watch it on my DVR. And then when he came out and did the whole Steve Harvey incident that happened at the Miss Universe pageant, hats off to R-Truth. He really made the night. So, I mean, that was funny. The Miss Dow was my favorite slammy moment with the Niagara commercial. That was a great funny moment. So. Funny night on Monday Night Raw, but Roman Reigns looks he looks like a punk now. Stupid grin on his face that I really don't care to see. So Monday Night Raw didn't make the cut.
Monday Night Raw deserves one of these. Absolutely. All right, so real quick, I have to do trivia. Who's the longest reigning U.S. champion in history? Not only. And the history of the title, the longest reigning United States champion. All right, real quick, let's do it.
It is now time for the flavor of the week.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, number 30 participants, 99 to 2004. China was the 34-99. In 2000, the number 30 was X-Pac. Got eliminated by The Rock. And X-Pac was one of the final four in 2000. So we're going to go backwards. We're going to talk more about 2000 next week. But as far as 99, I said that. And then as far as 98, the 30th was Vader. Gets eliminated by Goldust. Only stays in the match for only a couple of minutes, very interestingly enough. The Undertaker by Austin, who ends up winning the whole thing. He stays in there for over 45 minutes. Didn't win the title that year, though. Went against Bret Hart. Duke the Dumpster Drosy stayed in there for a little over a minute. Gets eliminated by Diesel and Kama in 96. 95, number 30 was Crush. Stayed in there for almost 9 minutes. Gets eliminated by the British Bulldog, which was the runner-up that year with Shawn Michaels. And then finally, 94, the number 30 was Adam Bomb. Stayed in there for about 5 minutes. Gets eliminated by Lex Luger, who co-won that year. Which one of those rumbles in about 30 seconds, which one of those sticks out to you the most?
Sticks out probably Stone Cold Steve Austin when he won. I mean, he was at the height of his fame. And number 30 entrance never really did a whole lot. Everyone vies for it. I mean, obviously, number one entrance always the one who can outlast everybody and, you know, survival of the fittest, so... But again, Stone Cold Steve Austin to win in it. Not going to win the title, but it was most memorable for me just for the fact it was the Attitude Era. And I remember 99 Royal Rumble was horrible, but either way, that was probably my best.
I agree that the 99 with Vince winning was just absolutely horrible. And standing, going in the concession stands and out the ring and staying out for most of the time, it was just, it was really, really weird. Lex Luger is the correct answer, so you deserve one of these. Good job there. Correct answer. Good job. All right, so ladies and gentlemen, that is 195 in a nutshell. Great interview by the Fallen Angel, Christopher Daniels. I just love when people appreciate the business. 45 years old, 23 years in the business, and loves the fans. That's what it's all about. And as he's thanking the fans, he's even thanking my fans. So that's incredible. So thank you so much, Christopher Daniels. Great interview. One of my favorites. So thank you. Listen, everyone, Merry Christmas. Enjoy, enjoy, enjoy. Celebrate the reason for the season. And I'm not afraid to say that that's Jesus. So enjoy. Have a great Christmas. God bless. Goodbye.